This Emmy-nominated episode of the DTFH has been brought to you by Squarespace.com. Head over to squarespace.com/Duncan for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. The following message has been brought to you by the cold viruses currently inhabiting my upper respiratory tract.
Can you sneeze? Please sneeze, 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 sneezing good. More sneeze, please. Hand wash bad. Don't wash hands. Fly on planes. Planes are good.
It was another classic American summer. April 666, 2018. Chinese space stations falling out of the sky on Easter. The sound of ethereal trumpets blasting over Hawaii. And the president's attorney being raided by the FBI. Hello, Summer. Glad you're here again. Time to pop open a cold one and remind yourself that you're a spark of the divine identity whose original purpose is to serve and to love. Because you're made of love. That's what you are.
Learn that this is the womb of all creatures. I am the source of all the universe, just as I am its dissolution. Nothing is higher than I am, Arjuna. All that exists is woven on me like a web of pearls on thread. I am the taste in water, Arjuna, the light in the moon and sun, Om, resonant in all sacred lore, the sound in space, valor in men. I am the pure fragrance in earth, the brilliance in fire, the life in all living creatures, the penance in ascetics. Know me, Arjuna, as every creature's timeless seed, the understanding of intelligent men, the brilliance of fiery heroes. Of strong men, I am strength without the emotion of desire. In creatures, I am the desire that does not impede sacred duty. Know that nature's qualities come from me, lucidity, passion, and dark inertia. I am not in them, they are in me. All this universe, deluded by the qualities inherent in nature, fails to know that I am beyond them and unchanging. Composed of nature's qualities, my divine magic is hard to escape.
That was the Bhagavad Gita being read by Jacob Needleman, who sounds like he just mainlined a big blast of elephant testosterone. This is Duncan Trussell. You're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. If this is your first time listening, this is the nation's number one sports podcast. We talk about sports. We talk about sweat. We talk about men and women. We talk about sweaty men and women and the sweat running off of the men and women who are sweating in the many rings and arenas and fields of our beautiful planet's sporting areas. And we talk about the way they smell, the musky fragrance of their underguts and underarms, and the way their feet smell and taste, and the way the moist insides of their vulvas, labias, and foreskins feel and taste. And we have got a fantastic episode for you today. Aubrey Marcus is here with us today. We're going to jump right into that, but first, some quick business. Fertility ritual. The website. It's time. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Head to squarespace.com/Duncan for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. It was Mahatma Gandhi who described ideas as cosmic jizz, and the internet, the ovum upon which we explode these ideas. Squarespace is a trembling digital womb, fertile and ready for you to grow your ideas into a beautiful website. Maybe you want to make some incredible announcement or promote your online business or sell products or services. I've said it before, I have to say it every time. I know someone who sells their stinky socks online. Maybe you just want to showcase your work Whatever it is, Squarespace can help you by giving you beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, and everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. Squarespace, they've got 24/7 award-winning customer support, free and secure hosting, built-in search engine optimization. But the greatest plug I can give for them is my website was created using Squarespace. And every time I upload an episode of this podcast, I use a Squarespace website. Make it. It's time for you to create a beautiful website without enlisting someone who could be a charlatan web designer, someone who could infiltrate your life and actually be some kind of Nosferatu disguised as a web designer, someone who could very easily have steel teeth with tiny poison gelatin capsules embedded inside of them that while you are sleeping, they will skitter through your window and inject these capsules into your spine, causing you to have a lifetime of nightmares. Why would you want to risk that when you can go to squarespace.com and build a website yourself? Head to squarespace.com/Duncan for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. I offer the 950 salutes of the 950 masked and feathered falcon men of the Falcon Feathered Mountains of Nevada to the 950 Patreon subscribers that have subscribed to us over at patreon.com/DTFH. If you're sick of these commercials, if you're squeezing your fingernails into your hands in rage because you have to listen to commercials and rambling opening monologues and whatever the fuck, and you just want to jump right into the interviews, and you're just sick of this opening shit. This opening shit is the opposite of the first sip of a LaCroix to you. Or maybe you want more of this weird opening stuff. Maybe you're looking for longer opening rants and rambles minus the annoying interviews. Or maybe you're just somebody who wants to control another person, and you know that by becoming my patron, I will have to bow down to an effigy of you that I've made in my closet of pain where I lash myself with a thorned whip. Whatever your reasons may be, I encourage you to head over to patreon.com/DTFH and sign up. We're getting a Discord server set up. It's already running, but we're getting it tuned in, getting all the bells and whistles tuned in. So it's a place where you can join in a conversation with other listeners of the DTFH and talk with them about the things that matter most. And by things that matter most, I mean the sweet smell of the underscrotum of a soccer player, or that wafty, musky blast that comes from the back neck flap of a basketball player who just fell to the ground in a puddle of sweat. Also, much thanks to those of you who continue to use the Amazon link, which is located in the comments section of any of these episodes. All you got to do is click on that link if you want to buy something you hear us yapping about on this podcast, and Amazon will give us a very small percentage of that. We also have a shop with t-shirts, posters, and stickers. All right, friends. Now, without further ado, let us welcome to the DTFH the CEO of Onnit, author of a brand new book called Own the Day, Own Your Life. I'm lucky enough to call a friend, the great Aubrey Marcus. Aubrey, welcome back, man. It's so good to see you.
Man, it's good to see you too, brother.
Been way too long.
It has been.
Way too long. You've been working really hard, man. I follow your work online, and it just seems like you've expanded at this massive rate. What's happening here? What's going on?
Well, I wrote a book, and I had no idea how hard that was going to be to do. I mean, because it's a true commitment to the process and to the research and to everything that goes into it, and then the rewriting, and then the all the steps that go into making it. It's a birth.
You've been writing this for a while, though.
2 years, yeah.
2 years.
But the pace accelerates because you have that deadline and it's 9 months. You're like, yeah, I'll knock it out in the last six. And then we had to, you know, then you start accelerating and then you turn it in and then they turn you back the draft. And I rewrote it like 3, 4, 5 times. Every time I'd look back at it, my craft as a writer got better. So I'd look back and be like, did a fucking child write this?
Wow. You know? And
so yeah, it was a process. That on top of the Onnit stuff and relationship and life and my own personal growth. It's been a sprint.
How do you know when you're done with a book?
When you read it that final time and you go, this is dope.
But you got to read the book. You got to keep reading your own book over and over again.
20 times. I don't know how many times I've read the book because I literally rewrote it at least 5 or 6.
Do you have it memorized?
No, my memory's not that good. But I did read the Audible version, which was like another time, which was really challenging too. Just 7.5 hours just reading the book cold. So I know it well.
You're becoming a teacher. Not that you weren't before, but it seems like you're growing into this role as a teacher. Is that a safe assessment of what's happening here?
I mean, I just consider myself a student that's good at talking about the difficult shit that I go through. You know, like I just try to document the process that I'm in. And, you know, we're all really the same. We have different circumstances, different situations, but most of us are going through the same shit. And I was always just been given the ability to communicate the shit that I'm going through. I mean, that's the only difference for me is I'm willing to steer into the deep waters and just talk about it. And I think, you know, I think that's been beneficial to a lot of people, but really this is me just sharing the hardships and the triumphs and everything that I'm going through.
There's a documentary I just saw on yoga. It's on Netflix. Pretty cool. But they interview a bunch of spiritual teachers and I can't remember her name. She's pretty amazing. I think she runs like Golden Bridge Yoga. I could be all wrong about this. I wish I could remember her name. She seems pretty cool. But she said, don't die a student. Die a teacher. It's better to die a teacher. She's like, because being a student is fantastic. But at some point, you got to like start taking on a different role and passing all the stuff you've got as a student down into the world. But you... Do you feel that there's some stigma attached to being a teacher, or do you feel nervous about calling yourself a teacher?
I think that's something for other people to call you. You know, I always want to look at myself as a student because there's a danger of looking at yourself as a teacher. We've all had those teachers where the student makes a point and the teacher, because he's the teacher, is like, no, that's wrong. And this reason, this kind of academic superiority, ego nonsense. And I think if other people want to call me a teacher, great. You know, if other people want to call you something else praiseworthy, great. But for me, I just want to keep learning and keep sharing and let that, because I have to focus on that process. Because if my identity gets wrapped up in being a teacher and I get my ego involved in being a teacher, then I'll start looking at how effective my teachings are instead of just really learning and sharing. And so it's more of like...
I challenge you.
Sure.
Your identity seems to be wrapped up in being a student.
I think that's my process is wrapped up in being a student. Like I know how deep it goes. Cause I've gone the other way. I've gone into an ayahuasca ceremony being like, I got this shit figured out. You know, I think I've plumbed the deep waters enough. I've dived into the caves. I understand where my demons are, and then just get my mind fucking completely blown. Right. Or, you know, at every point where I think I have something figured out, I'll just do something that makes me just laugh at myself and say, right. Oh, you are so dumb.
Right.
You are so dumb.
Right.
And that happens to me fucking constantly.
Right.
You know, so I just have to accept the fact that, you know, while I'm way farther along than I've ever been and I've accumulated way more knowledge than ever and that knowledge is helpful, I'm still really dumb. I know that. And I keep getting taught that over and over and over again. I mean, most recently, I did 6 grams of psilocybin, and it really showed me. I was just laughing for like 5 hours at how dumb I was.
Wow.
And it was amazing. It was like, you're so dumb, and it's incredible.
Define dumb.
Getting caught up in my own delusions of the mind, the things that I thought were important, the things that I put value in, the things that I allowed to stress me, these clouds that I was not seeing the truth through. And also the way that I was structuring my body, the way I was structuring my practices. And, you know, it was just, I was laughing with the hilarity of, the universe, the hilarity of God, just howling at how funny it was.
Yeah.
All of the things that I had put myself through when truth and life was so beautiful that I could just stare at my hands and watch the sacred geometry of my skin stretching over my knuckles. And it was pure ecstasy as the sun beat down on me. Like, that was truth. And then here I am worried about this thing or that thing and these little trivial things when the experience of having sex with all life, all things around me was available at all points.
Yeah. Yeah. That somebody explained that to me as the wobble. I don't know if we talked about this or not, but it's the way that as a human we go in and out of those states of. I'm so sorry. Speaking of ridiculousness. Do you hear the fucking poodle squeaking its squeeze toy?
I do.
See, that's existence. Which is that, like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter if you, like, if you reach some, like, height state of whatever. It doesn't matter because inevitably some fucking poodle in the form of whatever it may be is going to start squeaking its fucking squeeze toy in front of you and remind you that it's not that important. You know, but let me just handle this. I'm going to euthanize him. Like, I think this is the last straw. Man, I want to talk to you about consuming that much psilocybin. I've never taken that much before.
Neither had I.
So did you, what was your process there? Did you chew them up? Did you blend it up?
Blended in some lemon and green juice, actually, on a full fast. So fasted through the night, took them in the morning. Blended with some citrus, which helps kind of unlock and break it down a little bit. And some green juice just for the nutrients and minerals. And that was it. Off we go. And it was, I've never even approached that dose. I've never gone above 3. And, you know, I didn't know what, you know, I've always heard this heroic dose. It always sounded just like stupid to me.
Yeah.
But there was real, real value in there. Challenge as well. Challenge on both sides in the process and in the integration. But it was really, really interesting because when it came on, it was the closest I've gone to a full dissolve, probably. I mean, 5-MeO, you get a full dissolve, but in a different way. This, I just completely released into the sacred geometry. And it was a beautiful setting. The sun was shining. We had a, you know, an amazing day, and it was outside. And I think that, to me, was a much preferable way. The night seems to bring out a lot of the shadow and adds another element of fear that you have to work through. And if you want to work through that fear, go for it. You know, do the night. It's one of the reasons why ayahuasca in the night is very intense. Everything is more intense at night. We did it in the morning, sunshine, and I just allowed myself to dissolve into the sacred geometry as the sun poured through me, and I was just oranges and yellows and light for about 40 minutes. And there was no me. It was just orange, yellow light. And I was the sun and I was energy. And that was pure. And then I kind of came to. And I remember, as I was saying, like just looking at my hands up in the sky and just marveling at the monkey body that I had a chance to express my light through. And it was fucking phenomenal, man.
What was the onset like? The first 5, 10, 15 minutes? Like, what, with that high a dose, I've always been curious about how it comes on.
I mean, it comes on and it's like familiar. Like, okay, here come the mushrooms. Whoa, this has power. This has power that I've never felt before. This is another thing. And then for me, I'm comfortable letting go. You know, I mean, I've practiced that muscle of letting go. And I do not recommend this for people who do not have that muscle really well practiced.
Wow.
Because if I resisted and tried to hang on to reality, it would have been terror, just sheer terror.
You get PTSD.
There was no hanging on to reality. So surrender to the geometry. And, you know, I was able to release pretty easily. But it was so complete and so powerful that it was really recalibrating in an interesting way.
Yeah, that is the muscle of letting go. That's a really great way to put it. Because if you fight against the psychedelic, it is so unkind to you. And kind, it's being kind to you because it's showing
it's
you...
It's teaching you not to fight.
It's teaching you that where there is attachment, there is suffering.
Yeah.
And that's like the main thing. It's just, my God, when it decides to dissolve you, in whatever way it decides to dissolve you, is it just depends on the way it does it. You know, I don't know. I've had, you know, I want to ask you something though, before we get more into psychedelic talks. Do you ever feel nervous about being so public with your consumption of psychedelics?
This to me, all right, you said before, better to die a teacher. To me, it's better to die a warrior. And I believe in these medicines. I believe in their ability to cure me. I know they've helped me in immense ways. And I know they can help people, especially if they use them responsibly, especially with the work that Hefter and MAPS is doing to legalize them and put them in the right context, the right set and setting. If I was, I'm comfortable with the fact that if this had repercussions, I go out on my shield. I go out speaking my truth. I go out trying to help the world because that's what I'm fucking here for. And if I die, if I get slain, you know, if I'm there fighting off sodomy in some fucking state prison for whatever, which it wouldn't go that far. I've never sold or anything like that. I don't even deal. I don't even have it on my person. I usually go somewhere and consume it. So my risk tolerance is low, but, you know, my risk is actually low. But I am comfortable that if someone came in to take me to jail for this or do whatever, okay, at least I'm dying for my cause.
That's
what I mean? Like, I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool, man. That's a good way to look at it. It's just, I can remember when I was at the Singularity University up in San Francisco, we had this great conversation about problems with surveillance and essentially the problem of surveillance becoming more advanced and everything, every little bit of data that can be recorded being recorded by the Alexas and the in home cameras and the cloud and like all of it being recorded and accessible, that it produces a problem of future tyranny. Now, this doesn't change your... well, if you're willing to die, you're willing to die for a thing. But it does shift risk, because when we consider risk now, we're thinking of risk based on the current way things are. And we've got, you know, people like Trump suggesting death for drug dealers. You know what I mean? And you look and you see like, my God, like this can happen. And then you think, well, things can slide even further, right? Not to go jaunting off into the land of paranoia and fear. But one of my friends, as I was yapping about this, said to me, dude, if they want you, they have you. Like,
the thing is, though, like that would be a very stupid move, you know, because if we're talking about the responsible advocacy of medicines that have gone through phase two clinical trials or on their way to approval, like psilocybin, like MDMA, like these plants that have been used for thousands of years, and a public figure like us, when we're not selling it, we're not charging people, we're just experiencing it on our own.
Yeah.
If they threw one of us in jail, like the amount of attention and the amount of outcry and the amount of motivation for people to put pressure on these ridiculous rules would be immense. You know, in a way, it would be this martyrdom act, and it would actually further the cause even more. Now, what hurts the cause is people being fucking knuckleheads and doing it in the wrong set and setting, pushing it too hard, taking more than they need. Like anybody listening to this, oh, Aubrey did a heroic dose, I got to do it. No, please, no. Like, do it only in the right place at the right time when it's right for you with the right people providing, when you trust the medicine. Don't go fucking willy-nilly, because that can hurt the cause. Because if you hurt yourself or hurt somebody else, that's going to be fuel for them to keep these oppressive measures in place.
Right.
You know, so like we have to talk about it responsibly and do it responsibly, all of us, so that we don't give that other force of fear any ammunition.
Gotcha. And what do you think is like the ultimate setting? I mean, I know you said outside, but, you know, if people listening are like, all right, I think I've worked up the letting go muscle. What do you think is like the best way to plan an expedition into the...
I think the first psychedelic is MDMA. And I think that is, I'm so happy that MAPS got their phase three trials funded.
Yes.
And that's going to be legal by 2021.
Yes.
And I think it's a great opportunity to do that in a perfectly legal set and setting. Experience your heart opening first, because that's where all the healing is. I've actually watched more healing happen on MDMA than all the ayahuasca, iboga. I watched cure a heroin addiction. I don't think MDMA can do that, but more personal trauma healing and more personal growth healing happen with MDMA than any of the other psychedelics. And we're like 2-3 years away from that being legal, you know? And so there's things that are coming that are going to be the right entry point to that. And the same with psilocybin, that's maybe a year or two behind that. But if you're not going to wait, you know, for these opportunities, then I think you have to be with someone who knows them. You have to know the material. You have to know that it's quality. You have to know that it's the right stuff. You know, there's people who think they're smoking DMT, they smoke something else, and they die.
Right. Like,
if you're ordering it from the black market or whatever, and you're just trying it on your own, you want someone there who's sober, sane, knows the material, and can be a guide.
Right.
You know? And then you want to do it in a really safe place, a place where you're not going to have paranoia. You're not going to worry about anything that's going on, a private, safe place, and have, you know, people who have a lot of love around and a lot of care. And
no secrets. Might I add to this? Yeah. That if you're going to do this with someone you have secrets with, don't do it with someone you're trying to keep a secret from, you know, because
and
I don't know. I disagree. I'll disagree. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why I disagree with that. It's not cool for that fucking person.
Guide.
No, yeah. Well, if you're like tripping with somebody,
yeah,
and they're holding something back from them, and then like because suddenly you're merging, and then they could see whatever that thing is. You know what I mean? It's not cool for them. Like, that's not the best way to, like, tell somebody whatever the thing is. You know what I mean?
With the exception being if you're doing MDMA with somebody, it may actually be the best time for them to receive that truth. But you should go in with that intention. Because what you're saying is absolutely right. Like, don't let it be an accident that it comes out.
Yeah.
Like, come together saying, hey, we're going to go through this ritual together.
Yeah.
And we're going to reach a place of radical truth. And I'm going to be very vulnerable. And I'm going to be very honest. And, you know, I want you to, you know, hopefully you can receive this in a positive way and set that intention. And again, that just goes back to the intention setting. Like, yeah, you're right. Like, don't have secrets and go on this journey and not want to tell them. Go into it with the intention of reaching truth, and that will ultimately facilitate a greater love. Like, truth and love, those are synonyms. You can't be in love with someone without being in truth with someone.
No way.
And same with the friendship, relationship, whatever.
But dude, think about how many people don't live in that way. Think about how many people, their entire life is defined by lies. Like, they're just hornet's nests full of like weird secrets. And this is the thing, like, I've been thinking about is like, so what happens is people get married and decide to have kids, right? And like, when people get married and decide to have kids, sometimes the reason they're getting married is because they think it's going to fix the problem of the truth, which is that both of those people don't really want to be alone, but they don't really like each other that much, or it's like whatever. And then all I'm saying is like, so much life comes into the world under the umbrella of like dishonesty.
Yeah.
How many people are born into a relationship where there's like big secrets hanging in the air? How many people are formed in the cauldron of dishonesty, you know, and are raised in that space? Because, you know, you hear people say like, oh, you know, we're going to get a divorce once the kids go to college. Like, think about that. Think about that. How fucking crazy that is to do to a kid, which is like, oh, we're going to pretend to be happy for your entire life.
So they can model pretend love and suffering. Like, whatever you show them, they'll model. You know, so people do have that absolutely backwards. And it's a shame. You know, that's what makes my heart hurt the most. That's one of the reasons why I'm willing to go out in this way and put myself on the line, because I've seen what the difference is. I've seen what the difference is with my fiance getting to radical truth, not only what I think I know, but what's truly underneath the surface. You know, the times that I've used, you know, a mirror that I placed between her legs for my own validation rather than actually just fucking her because I was fucking her. I was looking at myself in this mirror of, oh, am I doing a good job? Am I a man? All of these deep rooted things that come up that the medicines can help show you. And then you get to this truth, and then just love just floods yourself and floods your body. And you realize that we are in heaven, you know, and we have that ability. It's just our own clouds of lies and delusion that create a hell.
The lies are the wall that surrounds the Garden of Eden. And it's in when you know, my experience, and I'm not going to go into some long freaking another polyamory ramble here, but my experience with being with somebody where there's no lies at all, and there's just love, and there's no like, and you just say it, man. Like, whatever the thing is you're feeling, you just say it. If you're jealous, you say you're jealous. If you're, you know, if you're
And then you can relax.
Yeah. If you're attracted to somebody, you say you're attracted to somebody. If they're attracted to somebody, they say they're attracted to somebody. If you say, oh, that makes me jealous, they're like, Yeah. Well, or if they're, it's like, but that is one of the most profoundly psychedelic experiences of my life, to connect with somebody at that level, where there's like, not only is there like an agreement to be completely honest, but that's because love is there at the other side of that honesty. There's always just love. It's mm-hmm. just love.
You're always forgiven.
Yeah. And that mm-hmm. is the most fucking psychedelic, crazy, telepathic. It's like a form of telepathy almost. Yeah. It's the craziest thing ever.
It's the best.
And this is one of the wild things I've discovered in it, is that sexual pleasure and like radical honesty, they're almost equally pleasurable. You mm-hmm. know, the act of like just telling the truth to someone and pouring out your heart and letting them do it, it's weirdly like having sex. Mm. You don't even have to touch them, you know? But like in that...
It's like heart sex.
Yeah, it's like heart sex. Yeah, yeah. Heart fucking.
And you know, and your eyes will orgasm tears of joy from the heart sex. And that's how you know. I mean, and it's been a crazy journey. You know, I've had my own challenges and hardships, you know, lately, a lot of them. Some, you know, I'm not even willing to talk about them on a podcast openly.
Yeah,
they're
sure.
very deep personal things. But it's cracked me to a point now where I've been in the deepest suffering of my life in certain ways, and also the deepest love of my life, where, you know, multiple times in a week, I will just stare into my lover's eyes, Whitney's eyes, and just my eyes will start watering with just joy and love and at being with her. And that's such a fucking rad feeling. And it's not just with people, you know, that happen with nature or with a friend or with, it's like, it's wild when you release all that stuff and you realize this is so fucking good.
Yeah. Yeah. That is unbelievable when you're just with someone and you just are looking at them and you both just start crying because you love each other so much.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with, like, for me, my experience with it has been like really interesting in the sense that I'm having to deal with the fact that a lot of the stuff you hear about, you know, the true love thing and that stuff, it just sounds like such fucking bullshit, man. And like, or the, you know, you hear people say, oh no, I'm like so deeply connected with this person that it's atomic or something. And then to like feel that, and then I have to start thinking like, oh my God, man, my cynicism, like what else has my cynicism blocked me from? What else have... What other things that you hear about and roll your fucking eyes at are real too? And it's just it's a beautiful thing, really. But to get there, man, it's like you said, you got to build that letting go muscle up pretty. You got to get really good at letting go.
Yeah. I mean, everything else you accomplish is, you know, you talk about the grind, you know, like as a comic, you got to grind.
Yeah.
You know, you got to hit the open mic. You got to push yourself. It's that very young energy, like go, 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 works, you know, try, try, try. And then with love, it's the opposite, because we are love. That's our state. That's our natural state of nature. We just got to let all the other shit go and let the love come. All you can't go searching for love.
Right.
You just remove everything else that's blocking it, because we are love.
Right.
That is our fucking state. So the more we let go, the more we surrender to that. And then here we are, population heaven, you know,
like, yeah,
that's it.
And then, but then sometimes, like, on occasion people will say to me, well, come on, Duncan, like, heaven, really? Like, what about Syria? I mean, you might be in heaven, Aubrey. You're running this fucking company that's, like, massively successful. You're, like, this fucking ripped, like, you know what I mean? You're, like, you know what I mean? You're
like that is an inoculation to hell. I promise you it's not. You know, I've been in emotional hell. Now, granted, there's people who are in physical hell beyond my even imagination, beyond my comparison, you know, and I recognize that. And that's a sad state, that the world still has places that impose physical hell and restriction. And that's brutal. And hopefully we can move toward a world where that's not there. But you can't judge somebody else's hell for the most part externally, because again, I've been to the slums, in the Soweto slums in Kenya, and I've seen way happier, heart-filled souls kicking little dirty soccer balls, avoiding little sewage traps because the shanties are all slanted downhill, and the ones on the bottom of the hill get the shit and sewage from the people at the top of the hill, and they haven't had a lot of food, and they're just fucking happy. And then I look at other kids and other people who were rich as shit, you know, in Greenwich, Connecticut, and they got, you know, everything at their disposal, and they're depressed and hitting pills and suicidal. Like, the internal hell is real. It doesn't matter about your external circumstances, and that's the one that we can control. You know, we have the ability to control that, and, you know, hopefully as we get better at that, then we'll get better at helping those people who are in states where they have a physical hell imposed on them.
Right. Yeah, that's right, man. It's so fascinating when you run into somebody who's got what on paper would be the dream, and yet they are so deeply miserable. And it's a really fascinating thing to realize that. And I mean, hearing it's a really, and it's also, it's a very beautiful and hopeful thing to realize that too, which is that it really doesn't matter what your surroundings are. There does seem to be some internal essential nature, which is the soul, as Ram Dass calls it, which I think the older I get, it's like, fuck it, I'll use that word.
Yeah.
The soul. And you know what he says sometimes, I love, man, is he's like, he'll say, he'll look out and be like, I see souls here. I don't see people. I see souls. This is an ocean of souls, and it's love. And that's on one level. And then on the other level, it's the melodrama, which is...
Well, it's what Paul said. We both had Paul Selig on our podcast. Yes. We both know him. It's the contrast between the small self, that egoic small self that's constantly finding conflict and comparing itself to others and caught up in the daily dramas. And then there's, in his language, the Christed self, or the true self, which is the expression of ourselves as love. You know, the I am here as our only name. You know, and we're both of those things, all of those things at the same time. You know, and it's about trying to shift your identification point to that soul level space and see other people in the soul level space so they don't trigger you. When you see someone caught up in their own thing, the first reaction is to judge them. But as Selig says, as soon as you judge someone, as soon as you put them in the cave of judgment, you go too in the cave of judgment. You follow them at their octave, at that level, to wherever you're judging. Whereas if you're like Ram Dass and say, I see beyond what you're presenting, I see the love, I see the soul inside you, then the whole world starts to look different.
It does. But what about the problem of like vampires? Like, what about the problem of like when this, all of this is great, you know, but you know, Neem Karoli Baba, he would jow, is what he'd tell people, go, jow, jow, out. Because like, you know what I mean? Like, it's sometimes like I get the thing. So I guess what I want to ask you, Aubrey, is when is it like spiritual, empathetic, deep connection with a person's inner soul? And when is it codependence? And how do you tell the difference?
I think there's a couple of things there, because I think one thing you're getting at is discretion, about knowing like where to keep your boundaries. You know, so if someone is taking more than they're giving, like, and you're just continually trying to look and see them for their best and just absorbing it. The metaphor I like to use is the rose. You know, the rose, the flower of the rose is our love. But a rose has thorns, and the thorns keep the careless from trampling and destroying the flower,
right?
But the thorns are on the rose. They don't jump out and bite people. They're not like spitting thorns, you know, at anybody nearby, like, hey, don't get near me, shooting like blow darts at people. They're just there. And they have, you know, and I think we all need to have that discretion to have our thorns there. So if someone goes to take more than we're willing to give, then put the thorns up. But it doesn't mean we judge them for it. We see them as a small trampling child. Like the rose looks at the child who's about to go in the thorn bush, says, oh, look, a child is here. I hope he doesn't hit the thorn. Oh, he hit the thorns. Well, now he'll know. You know what I mean? And that's, you can still see them in a high way, but still keep them, you know, keep them at bay by your own discretion.
That's pretty cool. Like you have just, it's not as though you, it's like you're, you, it's not like you have to, you're not fighting back. It's just one of the things that will happen if someone, you know, comes tramp. I get it. That's a beautiful way to look at it, man, for sure. I just, sometimes, you know, you'll meet people and you realize that they have like basically excused their cowardice as spirituality because they're terrified of confrontation. And so they're putting on a show of this kind of like, I am so open to the world that, do you know what I'm talking about?
I totally know.
And it's like, no, you're just afraid to fight. Like you don't want to get in a fight. You don't want to, you don't want to go through this thing that you know you got to go through, you know? That's a real trap that you can end up in, huh?
Totally.
You ever gotten stuck in that trap?
Not myself personally, but I've seen that. I've seen that played out. And, you know, I think certain times, you know, you can get this kind of haughtiness, think that you're, think that you've got it figured out, think that you're, you know, oh, this will be no problem. And again, open relationship is a great way to test the fuck out of that. Like, oh yeah, I understand that we're all one and it's all love. And then Whitney takes on another lover and I feel 1,000 knives stabbing me in the chest. And I go, uh-oh, I guess there's still some stuff there that I got to deal with.
1,000 knives.
Yeah. And then, you know, then you realize like there's still more work to do. And I think, again, it's just that humility and not identifying with the place that you're at. Like, you know, don't count your chips when you're at the table. Don't try and think about how enlightened you are on the path to getting enlightened, if you want to use that word, or waking up, or however you want to say it, is your own personal growth. Just be in the process and know that there's a long wave still to go, and just enjoy where you're at.
I think Ram Dass says this, like sometimes people say, I'm going to get enlightened. And he says, okay, great. Well, we'll be here when you get back. Something like that. I'm probably butchering it.
Yeah.
But it's like the, cause you know, like it's just this moment. It's like, that's the thing. It's like, this is just what's happening, is this is the thing right now. Like, mm-hmm. this is it. It's not some future state of some place. And to me, this is something that I've become acutely aware of. And is that sometimes if you start practicing, and like for me, that's chanting, and it's remembering to like get back in the moment and feel myself in the moment and be in the moment. And then sometimes you realize that you will find yourself, and I'm sorry if this sounds judgy, because it's like, God knows, man, I pop in and out of these states all the time. Mm-hmm. But when you, sometimes you get around real, like people are really, their amygdala's in fucking high gear, man. And they're like planning for like 7,000 different horrific scenarios that could happen within the next few months. And like, you know what I mean? You get her into that energy field, and it's like, it's challenging for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know really how to deal with it, in fact.
Well, I think you have to, again, see beyond what they're presenting, right? So like when they're presenting that, you recognize where their fear is coming from. You try to remind them, even with your own viewing of them, who they are. So, and it's a challenge. It's super challenging, especially if you're emotionally attached to that person. Then it's way easier for them to suck you in and trigger you to join them in their small self.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. But I think it's, and I've seen it before with shamans, and like you watch a great shaman and someone could be freaking out, flailing, and there is just no fear. Like, no, they see beyond it, and they see this, they have this deep faith in the medicine. They have this deep faith in who the person is, and they're just unshaken through that process. And that's right. Just holding their own vibration high enough where you don't get dragged into the drama that other people are presenting, and seeing them for their best self.
Right. Yeah. 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 That's, I mean, you know, all of these things are just considered like why we practice, and like thinking you're going to get to that place, you know, right away is ridiculous anyway. Like I it's just a really interesting predicament, I think many of us find ourselves in, which is like, the question is like, you know, like at Burning Man, it's all about radical inclusivity. You know what I mean? But like, you know, I was at a friend's house, right? And we're all hanging out. We're having the best fucking time, right? And we're sitting in my friend's lucky enough to have a hot tub. And we're sitting in my friend's hot tub. And somebody brought over their boyfriend, who was a very unhappy person. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, really, really unhappy. And in the sense of like, anytime his girlfriend started talking, he would like, he was very corrective to her, and very like, you know, like clearly just like, she couldn't really talk, man.
Just a bunch of resentment built up.
Yeah. 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 And, but her, you know, the point is like, his darkness was so palatable that there's a sense where you're like, well, I don't really feel like wasting my life.
That's time for the thorns. You know, that's discretion. That's saying, listen, you have a process. It's a deep process that you have to go through. Like, I am not going to subject myself to this process anymore. I send you away with love. You know, and I think Don Miguel Ruiz, who's one of my teachers who I've talked about before, you know, he's pretty harsh with it. But with love, he will tell somebody, you know, I don't have time for your emotions right now. You know, please go fix yourself and I'll be here waiting for you with love.
Ooh,
you know?
That's great.
And he has multiple lovers and he'll just tell him that, like, I don't accept this, you know, so do the work that you need to do, come back. And when you come back, I will have no judgment. I'll be here in love, but I'm not going to allow you to invade my space, just like I wouldn't allow someone to break into the house and, you know, take our stuff and, you know, hurt anyone in our house. You know, yeah, I would put my discretion up, you know, but you still, you know, it's just about the attitude that you carry with it. You know, but discretion is absolutely important. And I think you got to recognize when people are not ready to exist at the vibration you're at. And maybe the vibration you're at is an actual trigger for those people.
Right.
And so, like, you just being in that state of love causes them to get all flustered and frustrated. And you may actually be a real challenge for somebody just by holding love.
You know? Beautiful. Well said, man. And I must, you know, what a terrible interviewer I am. You're saying that you've written this. What's your book, man? What's it called?
Book is Focus. You know, I love talking about this stuff with you. I talk about the book a lot, but the book is setting the foundation, and the foundation is your body and your mind. So it's called Own the Day, Own Your Life. And it takes you through one day through the process to really support your foundation in the best way possible. Each individual step, backed by all the research and science, what you do when you wake up, what you should do to use cold therapy, use breath, use sunlight, use sleep, use exercise, use sex.
So let me guess, here's what you do. Let me just tell me how close this is to your book. So in the morning, probably what you should do is wake up, reach over, grab your phone, right? Look at Instagram for how long is it? Like an hour looking at Instagram?
At least.
An hour and a half, 2 hours of looking at Instagram. And then what you do is you get up. After you look at Instagram, you probably put on like some pajama bottoms.
No. First you check how many followers you have and then remind yourself that you're not valid and that you're really a piece of shit because everybody has more followers than you.
Oh, right.
And everybody has more likes. You got to self-deprecation
first. Shame yourself. Followership.
Okay, great.
Right, of course. And then so you get up. You put on your pajamas, bottoms, don't take a shower. And the thing is, don't take showers for at least 4 days, right? Like you shouldn't be cleaning yourself that much. Is that right?
Yeah, for sure. You know, definitely not.
And if
you do, only make sure that you're pandering to your comfort at all times. So
never
really stress yourself. You don't want to sweat. You don't want to get hot. You don't want to get cold. You don't want to get in the sun. Perfect.
Out of the sun. That's the main thing, right? And so then probably you get up. You don't take a shower. You go and you probably eat some kind of sugary cereal.
Pop-Tarts, Fruit Loops.
That's it, right. And then after you eat the Pop-Tarts and the Fruit Loops, because your blood sugar is spiking and then dropping, you go back to bed for another two.
No, just pound copious amounts of coffee and have some pastry with it. And then just keep eating sugar the whole time and more coffee and sugar because you're fighting off the exhaustion.
Right.
And then you just do that repeatedly until you get type 2 diabetes.
Okay,
and then you get to die and restart again and own the fucking day. That's what you do, Duncan. You ride that motherfucker till you hit the reset button. No, it's not what you do.
What do? When you wake up?
You lose a pound of water overnight. So the first thing you need to do is rehydrate. It's not just the water. You need the minerals too. So a pinch of sea salt, a little bit of lemon, the bioflavonoids wake up the system. Get a little bit of sunlight. That sets your circadian rhythm, your natural energy system that's going to ride with you throughout the day and help you get sleepy at night. And a little bit of movement too to get the body kind of woke up. And then the next thing that I recommend you do is start using one of the other great natural free doctors that's available, and that's the cold. So get in a warm shower, do all your hygiene stuff, and then turn that knob cold.
Right.
Because a couple minutes of cold exposure increases norepinephrine, decreases your cortisol and anxiety load, and allows you to drop those chronic states of stress and inflammation and also do other beneficial things like build cold shock proteins. There's 42% less chance of respiratory infections in one study for people who expose themselves to the cold. So it's building your immune system, all of these things. But probably the best part about using the cold is you train yourself to do something that's a little bit uncomfortable. and push yourself past these self-imposed limitations and actually do something that's good for yourself that you know you should do.
Wow, that's cool. So you're, so cold showers, which is interesting because the founder of the Hare Krishnas would say, don't take hot showers. He would just say, take cold showers. Don't even take a hot shower. Just fucking freeze your ass. Because a big part of that was like the thing you're talking about.
Austerity.
Yeah. And just like learning about these ridiculous comfort boundaries that you have. That's actually one of my favorite things is realizing like, oh my God, the thing I thought was comfortable was actually killing me. Yeah, it was like pain. It was not, that wasn't even comfort. That was like, I don't know what that was, but it wasn't comfort. So we got cold showers. Mm-hmm. We've got go out in the sun, right? And then like, but when do you start doing heroin? Is it like at 2?
Yeah, you want to time your heroin dose to when the pain is at the most, you know? So when you've pandered to your comfort and not gone in the deep waters and not explored your psyche, then heroin to the reset button.
Hurry,
hurry to the greatest psychedelic of all, which is death.
This is cool, man. I really love this, but this like breaking down like what a really good healthy day looks like.
Yep.
But do you have a place in this book for non-healthy days?
Totally. Well, I wanted to build in a day that you could repeat over and over again. You know, so it has times for excess. You know, like there will be times where you party, and I talk about, you know, damage mitigation strategies if you're super hungover. Like, let's say you just went balls out. Well, you're going to want to increase this mineral called molybdenum, which breaks down the toxic acetaldehyde that builds up and support your liver for glutathione. So we talk about those extreme circumstances, but then we also talk about, all right, what's the time of day that's best to drink a glass of wine or smoke a joint? Well, it's going to be actually after you work out, before you eat, because your blood volume is going to be the lowest. You're going to feel the biggest buzz while having to process the least amount of alcohol. So you're basically making yourself a cheap date. So after you work out, don't eat right away unless you're trying to be a bodybuilder and get fucking huge. But that's not what most people want. You know, growth hormone response will increase. And then have that glass of wine, connect with your loved ones, put on some music, play some instruments, do something, and get that little buzz from that one glass of wine, which is minimally toxic and perhaps even beneficial to the body at that point, depending on which studies you're looking at and what you're looking at. And enjoy that time of like really relaxing and living life, because this isn't all about just being the most productive machine that we can be. This is about fucking tasting, enjoying, experiencing everything that's available. And so I wanted to make this book include all of that shit too.
What are your thoughts on getting stoned and working out?
So marijuana, particularly for me, does increase somatic awareness. And I think for me, I like doing something more like yoga. You know, that feels better because I can really feel those when a yogi always has to remind me, spread your toes. You know what I mean? Or like spread your hands, feel that contact with the ground, drop your shoulders down. Because I don't have great somatic awareness sober. I mean, it's pretty good comparatively, but when I'm high, I have really good somatic awareness and I can start releasing inner muscles and knowing how far I can stretch and push. So I do think it's really valuable for that. Also for like myofascial release, like if you have a lacrosse ball or a tennis ball and you're rolling out muscles and you're high, I'll actually be able to feel the fascia, which is like saran wrap over your muscles that gets caught. And that controls the on off. That's what controls the contractions. So you'll be able to feel that when it might be stuck in on position, you'll feel it release. And it'll just go like, whew, and it'll feel like it melts.
Wow.
And I'll actually be aware of that when I'm high, whereas I'll do it in another way and I'll be like, oh yeah, my shoulders feel a little less tense, but I won't have ever known when that happened, you know, because I don't have the insight and the awareness. So I think marijuana can be really, really useful for that.
Except, you know what it's not useful for? When you fucking forget your goddamn locker number at the gym. That's happened to me twice at the gym now. Twice. So like the attendants, like they think I'm mentally disabled, because like I come in there and I'm like, you know, I'm excited to work out. I just started working out again. It fucking feels good, but I'm high as a kite, man. I love getting stoned and working out. I love it. And so like I'm like getting ready to go to the so you don't pay attention, and then you have to go into a fucking locker room filled with like fucking naked dudes, like, and it looks like you're trying to rob someone, because you're like putting your code into every, it like makes you want to start weeping. It's so sad, but there's solutions to that, I'm sure, that you address in your book.
That specific thing, yeah. When you're weeping in a locker room and there's people all around you with their dicks swinging around, that's chapter 19. Go check that out. I have a diagram. I even diagrammed when you have that really obese man who's like upper dick area has gotten so fat that it's enveloped his balls and his dick. God. So all there is a little cave.
Yeah.
Yeah. That guy, that one's really
like
special.
Like, how do you keep from getting an erection when you're yeah. around that?
You yeah. know, when you could fuck him in the, in so the concave dick hole.
It's so hard because you're like stone. You're feeling a little sexy. That guy comes padding up and you're just like, fuck, man. Now I've got to think about this on top of, I don't know where my goddamn walker is. Yeah, that's cool. This book sounds like incredible. I know, right? It's yeah. covering everything, yeah. man. What about in this book, do you address your views on non-monogamy at all? Do you talk about that?
I don't, you know, but I do address communication and ego and a lot of like the foundational principles that can ultimately lead to a more open relationship discussion. But, you know, the entirety of my next book is going to be based on love, relationship, and the delusions that keep us from that state of love. So I'm kind of saving that piece for an entire book because it's big and it's rich and it's challenging and it's a lot to talk about.
I remember standing in my kitchen with you in Pasadena and you were talking about polyamory to me. And I think you probably recognized that I think you probably saw something. I don't know, man, but you were like telling me about it in a really cool way. Like you weren't saying you should do this or this, but the way you were saying it was, it's kind of the same way some of my teachers talk to me. Not that you're a teacher, you're just a student. But like, I remember you telling me, and I'm looking at you and you're talking about the fact, like, you know what, every aspect of it, you know, yeah. and one of them is your lover will have lovers. And like, and I remember listening to you like, Aubrey, in my head, I'm thinking, fuck that, dude.
Yeah.
This cannot be making you happy. This just doesn't seem right, you know? And but fuck, dude. It's like, I always just think about that moment. And I always think about how right you were and how resistant I was. Yeah. And how, like, you were hurting me. You know what I mean? Not in, yeah. you know what I mean? Like, in it, but in the right way. It's interesting. And like, I think that's kind of the problem in talking about this publicly is that many people, I think, are hurt by it.
Sure.
Because they know they're not happy. Mm. And they know that like that this there must be a more evolved way to experience love in the universe or a way, not for everyone. It's not for everyone, but do you find that you get some blowback from your...
Oh, totally. Like, totally. I mean, people, it's very threatening because we have this idea that love needs to be possessed, you know, that we own it and we agree to own each other's love. And that's just not love. Love, like all ownership and desire for ownership is based in scarcity. It's saying that there's not enough. So I must possess all of it. I must own all of it. Love is not in scarcity. It's in abundance. And actually, the more you experience, the more you have. It's converse to that. And I think one of the reasons why I was talking to you about it is I know you've traveled the path to understand lowercase and capital L love and understand what that is. And when you really understand that, a lot of the rules that we prescribe by don't make sense. And they actually preclude us from having that kind of radical love where you love someone so much that you just want them to experience love wherever they get it. And you love even the strangers so much that you're happy when they're experiencing love through someone you love. And it's a really highly conscious place, but in order to get there, you'll be fucking challenged to death. I mean, the thousand knives are real. Like I've had a lot of bad, you know, tough things happen. I've watched my father go insane. I've had, you know, my cousin who is like a brother to me die in a tragic car crash. I've had terrible moments that are very hard. You know, this is right up there with any of those. If not, you know, in what I feel in the actual pain, even greater, you know, releasing some of these parts of my ego, these things that I thought made me who I was, you know, that I had to be the most dominant lover or I had to be this or I had to be that. And letting all that go has been very challenging, but also helped make me who I am, you know. So it has been one of my greatest teachers.
Yeah, because it's like it's a lot of weight to carry around, man. It is. It's a lot of weight to carry around, and like I understand why people do it because I did it. I mean, one of the things that is ridiculous is I remember like having been like through multiple relationships. I don't want to say relationships fail because that's dumb. Relationships just end sometimes, and like, but I remember like having been through like multiple relationships that were plagued by jealousy and plagued by certain rooms in the house that you just can't go into. You know, like that's mm-hmm. two people in a monogamous relationship, quite often they're like, they're in this house and there's like at least four doors that are like locked and they're like, don't go in that door.
Yeah.
Definitely don't open. Just don't go in the door of it. Can you fucking imagine if like you came over and I showed you a door and I was like, please never open that, Aubrey. Just trust me. Don't open that fucking door. How creeped out you would be. You would be so deeply creeped out. And so like, it's such a dark place to find yourself. And, but I remember in that place hearing people like you talk about this polyamory stuff and having the fucking, talk about being dumb, having like being so dumb that I can't even look at my own like series of pretty like relationships that end and pretty, you know, just end based on jealousy or weirdness or whatever, and thinking like, dude, polyamory doesn't work, man. You know what I mean? Like that, that's what's crazy.
Yeah,
is when people who are like, now I get someone in a monogamous, happy, joyful relationship where they're like, this is, you know, right now this is what, where we're at, and
sure,
it's working, you know, maybe being like, you know, polyamory doesn't work. But I don't think that, I've never seen that. Like usually it's like people are in pretty like rotten relationships being like, that shit don't work. Yeah. You know, because what they're going through isn't working.
I think there's, you have to be at truth. Like truth and love are synonyms. You gotta like really remember that. So you have to be in truth with your person. Now that's at the bare minimum. And you can have a monogamous container, but I think the minimum ante, if you're going to play with actual love, the minimum ante is to say, we both want to sleep with other people. We'd both like to love other people, but we're both consciously making a sacrifice and only providing that for each other. It's not because you're the best and I would never be interested in anybody and all of this. Like, let's acknowledge this conscious sacrifice that both of us are making, and let's honor that and let's make that special and say, hey, we're consciously sacrificing this despite our primal nature, our animal nature, our spiritual nature, wanting to explore. We're doing this for each other. And that's something that we're happy with. And that's truth. And that's an acceptance of limitations. But you're both going in willingly as a choice and still abiding by truth. And if you're abiding by truth, then you can have real love.
So, yes, go ahead. Sorry.
I think just that's the ante. Now, what you actually do with your body and what the rules you create, well, that, you know, that can follow from that. But bare minimum, you got to get to truth.
Got to get to truth. And also, how about like the one thing I'm learning in it is just the concept of like, well, this is what we're doing now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Instead of being like, oh, this is forever. Like, here's the way we're going to play the game forever. It's like, well, you know, right now, this is what we're doing. But this is definitely not going to be a permanent state. It's, and I don't know if people realize, like in monogamy, what happens is like, this is what we're doing forever. Like, this is forever. Yeah. This is
till death do us part.
Yes, yes. Till death do us part. This is what we're, this is the rule. This is how it works. If you go outside of this rule, you could end up on Cheaters, dude. You can end up like in front of a 7-Eleven with like a camera crew coming out with your fucking condoms in your hand. You're like, what the fuck is, but
at least you had condoms in your hand.
You have fucking condoms, man. You know what I mean? Yeah, at least you're using condoms.
Could be worse.
But the thing I like about polyamory is that it's fluid in the sense that it's like, well, here's the thing we can do now. And this is just for now. Like, it's the next thing that's coming is what we'll be honest about, you know? And I don't know. I think there's something really beautiful in the acknowledging that human relationships are fluid, changing things that you can't really come up with some eternal rule. I mean, you can to some degree.
I think we gotta just break it down to the really simple. Like, when you say I love you, that really means I want you to experience the greatest happiness. If you love someone, I want you to experience the most you possibly can out of life. And you're not asking for something in return. Like, real love is, I want you to be as fucking happy, radiant, fulfilled as humanly possible. Yes. And if the other person can say that, I want you to be as happy, fulfilled, radiant, expressed as you can possibly be. And I want us to enjoy this together. Like, okay, you have that agreement. And then that's like the foundational agreement. And then you start to figure out what pieces support that, you know, and what are things that are going to be helpfully challenging, and what are things that are going to be too much a load to bear. You know, there's also a problem with trying to move too fast. Like, okay, we're open now, and oh shit, I just had a gangbang with six people. You okay with that? You know, like right off the bat. Yeah. And it might be too much load. But as if you're willing to work with somebody and say, all right, here's the amount of stress and that we can handle in this relationship. We're in this together. How do you feel about this? Let's try to open this up in a way that doesn't create additional trauma down the road, but move towards that and then rely back on that initial promise of, I just want you to be happy.
I think people get so confused about it from porn. And I think porn makes people think it's like completely different than what it is. So they start thinking that it's some kind of like porny situation that you're in. And it's like, not. It's people think that like, oh no, you can only have this one authentic connection with one person. Therefore, all the other people, it's just, you're just doing some kind of like random fucking or something, you know?
Yeah.
Forgive me. I'm so sorry. I don't know what it could be. Yeah. They hate it when I talk about polyamory. Hang on a second. Aubrey, do you have any favorite poets?
Favorite poets. You know, when I was younger, I liked Tennyson a lot. Rumi is probably one of my favorites. Hafez, both of the Sufi poets.
Yeah.
Hafez or Hafez?
Who the fuck knows, man? You say it anyway. I mean, I this is a funny
man,
thing.
Hafez is probably who I've been into the most recently, actually, I would say. And that's, he has some great lines. One of the poems, the title of the poem or the theme of the poem is God's favorite joke is two.
Wow.
And I was like, damn.
Yeah, man, that's cool. I'm only asking because, like, you're uploading your poetry online.
Yeah. Yeah. I started writing a lot more. And it's been cool because I used to write more poetry, but I think the deep pain that I've been through recently and then the deep love that I've been through recently, I mean, those are the two driving factors for most poetry is pain and love. And, you know, both of those have really come full force for me, and it's kind of unlocked that poetry that's it's always kind of been part of my heart.
You've got a lot of fucking courage, man. I don't know, because I'm trapped in my identity as like a comedian or whatever. The idea of like having the fucking balls to upload your poetry online, that is nuts, dude. Do you ever feel cheesy, or you ever feel like, fuck, what's wrong with me? I'm putting my poetry online. Like, what's happening to me?
You know, there's poetry is a very personal thing. Like, it's probably, of all the things that I get nervous doing, you know, I've spoken at the theater at Madison Square Garden, and there's a huge audience and a huge stage and public speaking and doing big podcasts, and I'll get up for those things. But nothing makes my heart just pound in my chest like reading my own poetry, because this is like really bearing my soul.
Yeah.
You know, because even on stage, there's something of a persona. A podcast is really usually a conversation with a friend, even if it's a big podcast like Rogan or Tim Ferriss. Yeah. So that it's more comfortable. But even reading my poetry to a room of 10, 20 people, you know, my heart will be pounding. But, you know, again, that's just something that I'm willing to take the arrows for, you know, and I do, you know, there are people who will, of course, shit on it, but then the overwhelming response is really positive. So it's not giving credence to those three people that go like, oh, cringe, man. Oh, what are you doing? Oh, blah, blah, blah. But the other people were like, wow, that brought a tear to my eye. Like, wow, that was really special. Like, that meant a lot, you know, and I'll take that balance any day. You know, if I'm helping people, great. Then allow, you know, I'm happy to take a few arrows for that.
Wow, dude. Do you, is that part of your book? Like the creative outlet? Like, is that in there about like getting out in front of people with your art?
You know, really what I want people to do in the book is just take the time to connect with themselves and like build that own self love, that own kind of self-assurance, that ability to quiet the mind. You know, this is a foundations book. And like what you're talking about is something actually I talk more about in my, I did an online course called Go For Your Win. And that one really covers more of how to birth these things from your soul into reality, like how to create your win in life. And I kind of cover that more there. But this is about the foundations. And before you can do that, you have to know your own poet's soul, and you have to know the own. And I think to do that, you have to get still. You have to find those moments to get out of your head. You have to connect with other people. You have to feel love. You have to, you know, and I think this is more of that kind of the basic steps to get there in this book.
Right. That's cool. Yeah. You know, and the other thing is like, if you're, I've noticed like, just from like, you know, whenever I start exercising again, my creativity like gets,
totally
goes through the roof, man. It's like when your body's feeling bad, it's harder to be inspired, you know,
you're just 100%.
Harder to feel.
And just to have that energy. I mean, so many of us are just suffering from just chronic exhaustion. We're just so tired. Like we don't even have the energy to do anything that we really, that makes our heart sing. And so making sure you take care of all of the energetic reserves, the hormone balances, the nutritional balances, the everything that you could, the circadian rhythm balance, the sleep balance, you know, and finding all the ways to get yourself in a state where you have the energy to actually give your gift and to really just fucking send it, to go for your win, to do the things that you're here to do. You have to take care of the basics first. Otherwise, it's going to be a real major headwind slowing you down.
Wow. Aubrey, it is always so inspiring to talk to you, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show again.
You're welcome, brother.
Tell them how to find you. Tell them when the book's coming out. All of how can we connect? Yeah,
best way to connect with me is Instagram, actually. So at Aubrey Marcus on Instagram. I'm always posting my best thoughts, my philosophy, content, pointing to the different stuff that's going on. And then if you're interested in the book, ownthedaybook.com. And pre-orders are awesome. So if you know you're able to pre-order, that's super helpful. Tells the bookstores that, you know, this is a book that people want, and deeply appreciative of everybody. I love going on your show because your people are the fucking coolest. They have so much love.
They love you, Aubrey.
I love them.
Love you. It's so inspiring, man. It's really cool. Like every time whenever I hang out with you, I walk away feeling so much better, man. You're doing great work.
Thank you,
it's exciting to be friends with such a great teacher.
I appreciate you, my man. It's great to see you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. All the links you need to get to Aubrey are going to be at duncantrussell.com. Much thanks to those of you who have subscribed over at patreon.com/DTFH. We'll see you real soon. We've got an excellent podcast coming up with one of the hosts of My Favorite Murder, Karen Kilgariff. That'll be later this week. See you soon. Hare Krishna.